Hi, Spencer.
Hi Annie, I understand you're in London right now.
I am. I'm here in scenic, freezing cold London.
It's pretty nice in Washington right now, so you're missing a bit.
No. I mean, it's been so we got here. It's the first time that my now fiance Ezra has ever been to London, and we came from kind of sunny Spain, and we got to Heathrow, and it was like 40 degrees and pouring rain. So it's kind of like stereotypically British weather that we've been enjoying.
Well, my good friend and former Washington Independent colleague, I believe that you may have breezed past the news here
Oh,
for
yeah,
this
fair point.
commemorative episode of Blogging Heads. Did you just say fiance?
I did just say fiance, and my understanding is that you two are adopting a ball and chain.
Why, yes, news travels fast in the age of the internet.
It's true. Well, yeah, so I suppose we should do formal introductions. But yes, I am Annie Lowry. I'm the economy reporter at Slate. I'm a former colleague and a friend of Spencer Ackerman's, and yes, I'm newly engaged.
Tell us about that. Might our readers, I'm sorry, our viewers, be familiar with your fiance?
No, my fiance is noting Blogging Heads contributor Ezra Klein, and go ahead and introduce yourself, Spencer.
My name is Spencer Ackerman. I'm a national security reporter for Wired.com's Danger Room blog. I write my own blog called Attackerman. And I am very much in love and now soon to be married to a lovely woman named Mandy Simon, who works for the ACLU. We try and keep that kind of separate from our work stuff. But something kind of strange happened. Your fiance proposed to you, I understand, on the same day that I proposed to mine.
Yes, indeed. And this is much to the amusement of the internet. I suppose that we can go ahead and clear up the rumor. It was not, in fact, a double proposal.
Yes, this is
And my
not kind of
understanding is
Reverend
that
Moon thing.
my understanding is that we're not having a double wedding. But I mean, that could be kind of cool. I joke. But yes. But yeah, it was November 1st. It was the day before the election. And we got engaged in the dive bar where we had had our first date, much to my delight. And so it was a big week last week.
Yeah, I went a little bit fancier and proposed to my then girlfriend and now fiance at Restaurant Nora, a really
Nice.
lovely place. And I guess, would it come as a surprise to you to know that your fiance and my old friend Ezra Klein talked about this a bit in advance, and we understood that this was going to happen on the same day. Sort of discover that by happy accident. It turns out that your anniversary is on the same day as my fiance's birthday. So it just seemed like, from my perspective, the right, the right time to do something that had been causing me a great amount of anticipation for a couple months now.
It's like and who knows how many other happy couples joined us. So yeah, this is kind of a it's a somewhat unusual edition of Blogging Heads in that I think we'll maybe get to discussing a little bit of news, but yeah, I think we're going to be talking about love. This is like blogging hearts and
This
relationships
is
and the
blocking hearts,
internet and
yes.
stuff. Yeah, so it was funny because like I'm a fairly private person and I use Twitter mostly in a professional capacity, but the response from the internet, where I write and I do my work was pretty great, and it was pretty overwhelming too. It's like it's been this sort of fantastic thing that since I got engaged, I've been hearing all of these wonderful stories from married people about how awesome married life is and how like it's like you never get the opportunity to hear that except for all of a sudden now, when you kind of announce it publicly. So like for instance, my mom, we're visiting my family who lives in London, and my mom had a party for a bunch of her friends so that to announce the engagement because they live in Europe and they never see us, and all of them just like told lots of stories about how great getting married is, how fun weddings are, and how awesome being married is generally up until the point that you have kids, which was pretty funny. So have you found the same? Have you found the response to be like overwhelming and exciting?
I really appreciate the volume of tweeters
Yeah.
who've decided that that they have it in their hearts to congratulate us. It's been really heartwarming to see you know, strange people who, or strangers, not, you know, only some of them I imagine are strange people, who are willing to just, you know, say very nice things to you from across the expanse of the internet. Because usually, you know, I just get people saying really nasty things to me.
Yeah, me too.
Through the vast outreaches of the internet. Surprising to me, I've started to get wedding spam via Twitter.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Have you encountered this? There are some individuals who are offering their wedding, their photography service.
Yeah. So I've gotten a bunch of that. I had a friend who sent me, a folder for my Google Reader, which is like filled with, wedding blogs. And it's this funny thing, we're getting engaged. It just seemed like the thing that I was really excited for was marriage, is actually, you know, being married. But the wedding like was kind of an afterthought. It was like, oh yeah, I guess we'll have to have a party and like make it legal and all of that. But it's been like sort of a frightening and interesting introduction into like the marriage industrial complex, which I had only, understood from afar. But yeah, no, I've gotten like tons and tons of spam and like just lots and lots of, it seems like, you know, the pressure is to have it be like a total and complete and extremely expensive production. So I feel like all of a sudden I've been introduced to this like major American industry that I didn't even recognize before. And it's been funny, like because the weddings that I've gone to for the most part beforehand have been like fairly, for the most part, fairly family oriented, sort of like backyard even type affairs. But it is just like, all of a sudden you realize how consumerized it has become. And I know that that's a cliche to say it now, but yeah, starting with the spam and moving on just to the, you know, somebody gave me like a checklist of things that you're supposed to do before you get married. And there's like 157 different things that you're supposed to purchase in order to just kind of like consecrate your relationship. And it's like I'm still like kind of wide-eyed and wonder it at all, and I'm not actually particularly worried about like organizing the wedding yet, but it's it's absolutely bananas. So you too have been, because you know, at least traditionally it's you know, it's something that the brides had to deal with, although I feel like now it's, you know, something that couples deal with together, which is probably better. But hey, yeah, have you been amazed by the kind of like consumerism and by the craziness of wedding planning?
Well, my fiance has started bringing home some magazines, and I've been perusing it that way, looking on the internet for places to get married, you know, stuff associated with the wedding, is starting to frighten me. Now that I think, as you say, there are lots of things you need to buy, lots of stuff to consider. I'm, you know, freaking out a little when we look at our preliminary guest list that we're forgetting people.
Yeah.
I've had some people, particularly family members, who expressed some distress that they found out about this through Facebook when they saw my relationship status updating. I like yourself, you know, thought more about being married and having, you know, the rest of my life with this amazing person more than I thought about what it takes to actually cross that threshold.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't really know if there's, you know, really any ameliorative way, you know, aside from just, you know, getting on with it and doing it and having, you know, what I hope is, you know, going to be a really, you know, fun time as opposed to an anxiety filled one. I imagine that it's just going to be, you know, more stressful before it gets less stressful.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. And, you know, I guess that the hope is that you just, you know, that it ends up being like pretty romantic and pretty fun. And I don't know if you've been doing this, but like along with hearing lots of stories from my parents and my parents' friends and like my married friends about how awesome marriage is, I've been like trying to assemble really good books about married couples. So like the first one that I sort of reached for that I'd read before but hadn't read like, you know, with an eye to like what marriage is and what it means was About Alice. I don't know if you've read that book.
I haven't, no.
Yeah, well, it's just this like wonderful story about a man whose wife has, unfortunately, by the time that I think that he finished the book, she'd passed away. But it was all about how like wonderful their marriage was, and that was pretty good to see. So that's what I'm focusing on now. And actually, I know that something else that we wanted to talk about was food. Because
yes, definitely.
Because yeah, and I feel like all the wedding stuff, it's all very new still. So I'm not even sure that I have anything interesting to say about it at all. I feel like I'm just like kind of like wide-eyed and like amazed by all of it.
You know, we should consult our friends Megan McArdle and Peter Suderman, two frequent Vlogging Heads guests whose wedding we attended. Indeed. I guess in June.
Yeah, it was like sometime in the summer, right?
Yeah, and they just bought a house, so Mandy and I are going to need to talk to them about that, and you know, really any other, you know, tips for what you do now on the practical side with the rest of your life.
Yeah.
If you'd you know, rather not, you know, be a renter forever. Even though there's very good, I think Quisantrop had something really great in Wired this month about why it's just better to rent for a while. That Annie, you might have some particular insight on. Food, yeah, for the time being. I understand that right after you guys got engaged, you decamped to Barcelona for a bit.
We've been on this long planned vacation. Essentially a vacation that was sort of like just built around like gluttony and eating. It was kind of grotesque, but the sort of centerpiece of the vacation was going to this restaurant, El Bulli, or as they say in Spain, El Bui, which is like this kind of temple of it's actually closing, but of kind of like super contemporary molecular gastronomy that we went to, which was, it was really fun. It's out in the middle of nowhere. You know, kind of even to the extent that you get to this small town that's like 2 hours outside of Barcelona, and then you take this like treacherous cab ride that's like a further 30 minutes until the middle of nowhere. And we had gotten there early for our reservation because we were so worried about missing it. And we're literally left on like the side of the road in pitch, pitch, pitch black because they don't open until they open. So they don't even turn their lights on until 7:30. So for 45 minutes, we sat outside of it on these rocks and we could like kind of hear the ocean and we could kind of hear goats bleeding, but other than that it was just like absolute silence, and we're like, oh my goodness, like we're never gonna find this, like we're gonna get hit by a car and we'll never make it, like we're going to be gored to death by wild animals. But then suddenly 40 minutes later the lights went on and it's like this beautiful, very, very casual, very nice place with this crazy, crazy food.
Now this is, in the eyes of many, not just the most innovative restaurant in the world, the flagship of Ferran Adrià's culinary empire,
mm-hmm.
but the best. You know, people have their Thomas Kellers and other chefs, but I'm curious if this was in fact the greatest meal you have ever had.
So, I mean, it's this interesting thing where, like, is it always the best food you've ever tasted? Like, the answer there is definitely no. Some of it is a little bit weird. So the way that the meal is structured is it was about 35 tiny, tiny, tiny courses, all of which were very inventive and very strange. Some ranged from just flavored ice to cleanse the palate, all the way to very, very heavy meat bites, essentially. And so they're all very different. And some was like, you know, quite familiar tasting. So they had like a blini that was stuffed with, oh my goodness, this was like the best thing I think I might have eaten at the meal. It was a blini that was stuffed with brie and had some white truffle on it. And it was just like warm and unctuous and like just tasted like the greatest grilled cheese you've ever had, and was absolutely something that was just, you know, you really recognized it. And then some things, like the weirdest thing that we actually ate was, I think, and the one thing that I really actively disliked was a kind of like a little ravioli that was filled with kind of like a liquid and ham. So it sort of burst in your mouth and was accompanied by cantaloupe juice. And I guess it was supposed to be a play on like prosciutto and melon. But it was actually so, so bizarre tasting that it was kind of weird. So it ranged from, and a lot of it was really inventive, but you know, one of the things that I think was kind of interesting about the meal is that like a lot of the industrial techniques that you see that they use to create like powdered cheese and, to transform the colors of ingredients so that you don't recognize them until you put them in your mouth are actually techniques that are essentially industrial. So like if you think about how a Dorito is made, it's like a complete feat of modern science. And it seems like what they're doing there is using those techniques but taking them and making really, really good food with them.
And this is what Adria's critique is, right? The idea that molecular gastronomy really isn't very foreign to what we tend to consume, and perhaps we should think about that a bit, even as you can elevate rather elegant elements, you know, mm-hmm. on the plane to something like that. But it sounds a bit like from what you're saying, that the molecular gastronomy portion is a bit toned down.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't consistent throughout the meal. For instance, like, the desserts were pretty familiar. But, like, some of it, yeah, you're absolutely, like, how did they do that? So, for instance, they had these little, it was called a mojito baguette, which was, it was kind of like a piece of bread that was made out of sugar, so it just dissolved in your mouth immediately, that was filled with, like, mojito gel. And I can't quite describe the texture of it. It was the sort of thing where you bit and it just felt like it was gone. And there were some really cool kind of like magic type things, like, you know, where you just have no idea how they did it. And that's definitely part of fun of the meal. So it was like the best meal that I've had, but I wouldn't necessarily say that it was always the best tasting. There were very few carbohydrates. You never really had to chew anything. You didn't actually have to use a knife throughout the entire meal. Everything was pre-cut into little bites for you. So it doesn't like have that kind of soul satisfying quality of like eating macaroni and cheese. And you realize that that is something that you generally want out of eating. And I know that other people have said that, you know, that wasn't like how they felt about it at all. I think it was Eric Asimov in the New York Times when he was writing about eating food at El Bulli that he said for the rest of the time that he was in Spain, he just kept on searching it out, like wanting those flavors, wanting those techniques, wanting those tastes. And he never felt like satisfied not getting them again. And like, actually after eating at El Bulli, what I wanted was like hamburgers, but it was really, really cool. And you know, what's great is it does seem that like, you know, for people who really like to eat and, you know, who are sort of like hobbyists about their food, and I really hate the term foodie, but like, sure, for foodies, It's funny how like democratic it has become, how, you know, in Washington, D.C., you can see a lot of these really crazy techniques, which I'm sure that you couldn't have, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, even when Adriel was doing them. And they really do show up all over the place. And that's kind of like one of the fun things about it. And not just in restaurants as well as like, you know, in your snack foods. And it was one of the funny things was right before we went, the last meal that I had had before it was like McDonald's in the airport, which was kind of perfect, right? Because McDonald's.
Did you do that on purpose? I have a feeling you did.
No, I mean, it was like kind of like purposeful once we realized what we were doing, but it wasn't like a sought out like McDonald's. But it is like, you know, they've spent so many billions of dollars perfecting the technique that goes into those food to the point that, you know, they always taste the same every single time you've had them, and they've tasted the same since you were a little kid, and, you know, they're kind of perfect in the same way. And I think McDonald's tastes really good, although, you know, I certainly have some problems with the way that it makes its food. And that is like one of the things that it's sort of interesting to like kind of appreciate the food around you for like the industrial marvel that it is. Like, I'm drinking Diet Coke right now, and that stuff is crazy.
Well, let's do an abrupt segue. I mean, did this give you some ideas for your wedding venue? Because I'm going to be presumptuous and just tell you, you know, you're welcome to come to our wedding. We'd like to have you guys there. We've been friends for a while now. I hope that's a reciprocal deal, because especially,
well,
you know,
we can fit you guys in. No,
okay, well, we hope. You know, fingers crossed here. Uh-huh. But what I really want to do is you know, find what's on the menu at the Klein Lowry wedding.
Well, I mean, weddings are known for their terrible, terrible food, right? You think about like how hard it is to actually simultaneously make dinner for like 200 people. Like, if you were to make dinner for 200 people for like tomorrow, and I gave you like $1,000 budget, like, what would you do?
Well, I remember, you know, joking once. I'm not sure if we ever took this to Megan and Peter, who probably would have been justly horrified. But we once joked about making it basically a challenge for the Internet Food Association, possibly which is another blog that we all do, or did at one point. I'm not sure if any of us actually write for it anymore. Actually catering our friend, you know, Megan McArdle and Peter Suderman's wedding.
Oh, wow.
Probably a terrible, you know, a terrible idea from the start. It was probably not conceived with a clear mind. Yeah, I would have no idea what I would, you know, try to prepare, what I would pull off. You know, there have been, you know, all of those Top Chef competitions for wedding challenges that look terrifying and look just absolutely like they're on the verge of ruining someone's wedding.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't really know if that's, you know, such a great idea, but, you know, now we're in a position of, you know, trying to find what we would like to eat on our wedding day. what could be pulled off for our friends, for our families,
sure.
For you know, something just that won't have people, you know, leaving and saying, "My God, that was terrible," you know, industrial wedding food.
Yeah,
I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah, it seems to me that, like, okay, so if you were to do our hypothetical wedding challenge, the thing you would have to make, like, lasagna, right? It has to be something that, like, is really, really easily scalable.
Right.
And can be, like, pre-cut and served at a high temperature, like ramen, maybe, or something like that. But I haven't started considering anything, or I've just started considering, like, everything about the wedding. And I think that, like, I've been lucky to go to some weddings where it does seem like, you know, essentially the food is, like, all meat, and then it's really good because you can just, like, cook dozens and dozens of steaks at a time or something. But, yeah, it's this funny thing where, you know, so I grew up Catholic, although I don't think that I'll have a Catholic wedding. But the whole point of, like, the Catholic marriage ceremony is that, like, everybody – well, it's not the whole point, but, you know, everybody gets the exact same one. And you know, it's just like the priest reads the same thing, and it's probably the exact same words or pretty close to the same words that your grandparents got married with. And, you know, one of the things that I find, like, both great and terrifying about, like, modern American weddings is that there's this great push for sort of, like, individualization, to, like, make your wedding some sort of, like, totem about yourself and, like, some sort of representation of who you are as a couple. And it's, like, an impulse that I simultaneously think is, like, really sweet and really great, because it isn't often that you're supposed to have something that's just, like, all about you. But at the same time, it does just feel like, you know, kind of sometimes like the epitome of American kind of arrogance and megalomania, that you're kind of supposed to, like, make a wedding into a projection of yourself, and you're supposed to kind of, like, validate your self-worth. And I feel like
I feel the tension there, but at the same time, I mean, you know, everything we write, we feel the need to share. That's an incredibly arrogant thing.
Sure.
You know, we, you know, rarely have unexpressed thoughts.
Yeah.
And you know, we do that in a far more intrusive environment socially than, you know, a wedding where you have a fair amount of leeway from anyone who'd be interested in coming to the wedding and anyone you would want to invite to make a statement about who you are and what the rest of your life with this person will be and what you envision in terms of your commitment. In having your commitment sort of witnessed, honored, and guaranteed by the people there. So, you know, is the wedding, in fact, you know, one of the least arrogant things that we would do in this day and age?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you bring up a good point. And certainly, you know, on blogging heads, which, like, to be super meta is all about, like, you know, expressing every small idea in your head and yet another sort of, like, form to express it.
I mean, we're presuming right here that people are interested in our personal lives. And blogging heads has kind of made that presumption by asking us to do this as well.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's, like, I think that these are all, like, good, you know, kind of, like, philosophical questions to consider. But I will say that I've never attended a wedding, and I've been to a bunch, but I've never attended a wedding where, like, the primary thought that I had was, like, ah, what does this say about American decadence? Like, every time they are just, like, really, really sweet, sincere functions that always do end up kind of seeming, like, not, you know, like, not emblematic of the couple, but just kind of, like, about them in a nice way.
So the theme for your wedding, I should understand, is American decadence.
Yeah, American decadence. Yes, that will be, you know, and it'll be interesting in these recessionary times to do that.
Right. So you know, how can we tie these themes together? Because we probably should talk about, you know, something in the news during these last segments. And I know you haven't, you know, it's been hard for me to focus. It must have been, you know, hard for you to focus on that stuff in Barcelona now and London. But, you know, we have the president going abroad, trying as hard as he can, or
yeah,
maybe not as hard as he can, but, you know, trying to do something that shows that trade can be bolstered overseas and have some kind of economic impact going back. I mean, you know, how should we understand this?
Well, I think that, so first of all, I think that obviously it was purposeful that the president left on this 10-day trip. to Asia, like right after the midterm elections happened. And I think it is a good reminder that, you know, there is a world outside of Washington politics and horse race politics. And in some ways for me, it was so refreshing to go after the elections. And I'm not a big horse race person at all. I always just want to like wake up on the Wednesday morning after the election and find out what happened. And, you know, I find it's almost sometimes kind of like depressing to watch. But, you know, immediately after, after that happened, you know, here the president goes on this trip that's primarily policy making. And then the lame duck session comes back and that will be back to primarily policy making too. And that's what I'm really interested in. So yeah, trade policy is really hard. You know, there hasn't been a global recession for some time. There's a global recession now. Everybody would like to export their way out of the recession. And so the president has bought for this sort of 5-year plan to double American exports. Easiest way to double exports is to manipulate the dollar, but you manipulate the dollar and you anger a whole bunch of other countries. You know, because you essentially advantage your exports as a, you know, in opposition to theirs. And it's interesting. And I haven't seen like a ton of great reporting about like ultimately how this trip has panned out. Yeah, do you have any thoughts about, you know, the meaning of that trip right after the election?
I mean, it seemed, you know, that once the, you know, this was a very delayed trip. You know, he'd been trying to get to Indonesia mm-hmm. for a very long time and events kept, you know, overtaking, the actual vantage. So it seemed somewhat cynical from, you know, from my vantage that, you know, he would just rebrand the trip to be about jobs and bring all of these CEOs, mm-hmm. along with him. You know, in India, there was, you know, quite a bit of talk about, you know, the ongoing relationship, drawing closer together with Pakistan and what that means for, mm-hmm. for Indo-US relations. You know, and it's been a singular, it's been a conspicuous achievement of the last, you know, three presidencies, you know, Clinton, Bush, and now Obama, that drawing together with India has been a serious foreign policy objective. I was struck to see, you know, the amount of resistance. I guess maybe perhaps it should have been unsurprising that Obama got when he started talking in that Indian town hall. About the relationship with Pakistan, you know, seeming, you know, with you know, some reminder of what was, you know, an undertone of the election that doesn't really seem to have, you know, figured so heavily, but still about, like, why the United States would, you know, resist, you know, calling Muslims terrorists and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, nevertheless, it seemed, you know, in India to be, you know, an undercurrent rather than a major theme. You know, I don't do trade policy. I'm too ignorant to really discuss that with you now. I do, you know, really wonder what, you know, the lasting, you know, impact of, you know, coming off an election. You know, everyone was saying, well, he's got to, you know, reestablish, you know, that he is president. You know, what better way to do that than in foreign policy? But in the lame duck, I mean, he's going to be dealt probably, one, if not two, you know, major setbacks. You know, one is going to be, it's probable at this point that Senators Levin and McCain are going to find a way to strip the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell out of a still unpassed defense bill so they can actually pass it. And then there's this, you know, enormous and very stalled nuclear weapons treaty with Russia called New START that both sides are kind of just anxiously wondering if it can be passed during the lame duck. Mm-hmm. I'm still pretty skeptical. It doesn't seem like there's much in the way of an upside for the Republicans to do this. And, you know, being a treaty, it needs 67 votes. You know, Senator Kyle, who's really the determinant factor here on the Republican side, has been pretty cagey. I don't see why he would want to do this in the lame duck. He can, you know, perhaps extract more concessions from the White House, but, you know, what he wants is more money for nuclear modernization of the existing stockpile. And I think they, you know, they're at $13.1 billion. Not really sure what else there is to give. I don't know. So, you know, it looks like he's going to come home after having, you know, this, you know, Republican landslide in the House and in the Senate as well. And now just get, you know, his clock clean a second time in the lame duck. When is supposed to be the kind of, you know, last gasp of him, you know, really advancing his agenda. So, you know, I'm not really sure what he gets him when he gets back.
Yeah, I mean, so I agree with you, and I think you touch on a good point that there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen in the lame duck, and I'm very fearful for what won't happen. On the economy side, I mean, so you mentioned two massive and very important pieces of of legislation. On the economy side, there's a bunch of stuff, but most importantly, there's another extension of unemployment benefits. We saw last week that the employment rate hasn't dropped, even though the economy is making, the private sector at least is making more jobs again, which is better, but hardly good. And then there's also, the tax issue. And if they don't pass a tax bill, all rates revert to, Clinton era levels, and they're going to be very high. And a lot of economists, nobody, Democrats or Republicans, wants them to jump back to that those levels for everybody. And I think you're right that the lame duck is going to be fascinating, and worrisome on a lot of, and I know that in other subject areas, there's just like dozens of other bills that are going to be really tough to get through the Senate that a lot of people are hoping for. And it's going to be very interesting. And so do you agree with the kind of conventional wisdom that, because we're looking at a gridlocked Congress for the next 2 years, and possibly much longer than that, do you think that Obama will pivot to becoming more of a foreign policy president and will focus more on international things that are a little bit closer to his control, given that it's going to be tough to get anything through the upcoming Congress with Speaker Boehner and with a very slim majority in the Senate?
Well, I'm not so sure that he would have greater success in doing that because, with a particularly, multilateralist foreign policy agenda as he's got, you really do need legislative buy-in, and you need this on national security as well as you do on foreign policy. There's going to be a debate over the next year about what terrorist detention policy ought to be. That's going to require congressional buy-in. If there's going to be any movement on arms control, that's going to require congressional buy-in. On war funding, there'll be, war funding sort of always passes. But in July of 2011, his plan is to start, extremely gradually withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. That's going to require, if not congressional buy-in, a tremendous amount of congressional influence. The services know very well, and the military commanders know very well who to talk to on the Hill if they want to push back on really any of these agendas. So it may be the case that he would look towards foreign policy as a way of just reasserting his authority, but there's still a lot that Congress does in that area. So it's just easy to overstate that.
I think on that entirely romantic, sorry,
Yes.
unromantic point, we've sort of come to the end of our scheduled blogging heads. This is a short edition, but if you have any closing thoughts, Spencer, mine is for the blogging heads commenters who have reasonably and unreasonably called me stupid 400 times and have supported my views and not supported my views. If you have any commentary about how great marriage is, I want to hear it. I'm collecting these stories.
Yes, please. Please do. I can't imagine anyone calling Annie Lowrey stupid. That is an extremely stupid
It's
thing to do.
it's about anybody who is on the internet. It's a I think that once you come on Blogging Heads, it's a rite of passage to be called stupid. So I appreciate it every time it happens.
All right. Well, I mean, we're marrying people we love, so
Yeah.
people can really say what they like, and it won't really matter.
Yeah, I mean,
But it, yeah.
anyway, so yeah, do you have any other closing thoughts? Oh, also, happy birthday, Blogging Heads.
Happy birthday, Blogging Heads! Definitely. 5 years, my word. What a wonderful bouncing toddler you've become.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
so smart. What a plenum. Really, just as my closing words, I'm just, really thrilled for my two good friends, Ezra and Annie, and congratulations. And I can't wait to see the rest of your lives together.
Yeah, and to you too. Congratulations to you and Mandy, and I wish you every happiness. And thanks to everybody who's watched this extremely unusual edition.
Yes. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye,
Bye.
Spencer.